Hear that? She doesn't even wake. Nothing, she says, half asleep. Stop it, Jacquetta. I'm asleep. The stone floor is icy beneath my bare feet. I jump back into bed and put my cold feet in the warm space near Elizabeth. She gives a little bad-tempered grunt and rolls away from me. And then, though I think I will lie in the warm and listen to the voices, I fall asleep. 6 days later, they tell me that my great-aunt, Jehan of Luxembourg, died in her sleep, in the darkest hour of the night, in Avignon, beside the great river Rhone. Then I know whose voice it was I heard, singing around the turrets. As soon as the English Duke of Bedford learns that Joan has lost her greatest protector, he sends the judge Pierre Cochon, with a troop of men behind him, to negotiate for her ransom. She is summoned by a church court on charges of heresy. Enormous sums of money change hands. 20,000 livres for the man who pulled her off his horse. 10,000 francs to be paid to my uncle with the good wishes of the King of England. My uncle does not listen to his wife, who pleads that Joan shall be left with us. I am too unimportant even to have a voice, and so I have to watch in silence, as my uncle makes an agreement that Joan shall be released to the church for questioning. I am not handing her over to the English, he says to his wife. As the demoiselle asked me, and I have not forgotten, I have not handed her over to the English. I have only released her to the church. This allows her to clear her name of all the charges against her. She will be judged by men of God. If she is innocent, they will say so, and she will be released. She looks at him as blankly as if he were death himself. And I wonder if he believes this nonsense, or if he thinks that we, being women, are such fools as to think that a church dependent on the English, with bishops appointed by the English, are going to tell their rulers and paymasters that the girl who raised all of France against them is just an ordinary girl. Perhaps a little noisy, perhaps a little naughty. And she should be given 3 Hail Marys and sent back to her farm, to her mother and her father and her cows. My lord, who is going to tell Joan? Is all I dare to ask. Oh, she knows already, he says over his shoulder as he goes out of the hall, to bid farewell to Pierre Cochon at the great gate. I sent a page to tell her to get ready. She is to leave with them now. As soon as I hear the words, I am filled with a sudden terror, a gale of premonition, and I start running, running as if for my own life. I don't even go to the women's apartments, where the page boy will have found Joan to tell her that the English are to have her. I don't run towards her old cell, thinking she has gone there to fetch her little knapsack of things, her wooden spoon, her sharp dagger, the prayer book that my great-aunt gave her. Instead, I race up the winding stair to the first floor above the great hall, and then dash across the gallery, through the tiny doorway, where the archway knocks my headdress off, tearing at the pins in my hair, and then I hammer up the circular stone stair, my feet pounding on the steps, my breath coming shorter and shorter, my gown clutched in my hands, so that I can burst out onto the flat roof of the very top of the tower and see Joan, poised like a bird ready to fly, balanced on the wall of the turret. As she hears the door bang open, she looks over her shoulder at me and hears me scream, Joan, no! And she steps out into the void below her. The worst thing of all, the very worst thing, is that she does not leap into nothing like a frightened deer. I was dreading that she would jump, but she does something far worse than that. She dives. She goes head first over the battlement, and as I fling myself to the edge, I can see that she goes down like a dancer, an acrobat, her hands clasped behind her, one leg extended like a dancer, the other bent, the toe pointed to her knee. And I see that for that heart-stopping moment as she falls, she is in the pose of Le Pendu, the hanged man, and she is going headfirst to her death, with his calm smile on her serene face. The thud when she hits the ground at the base of the tower is terrible. It echoes in my ears, as if it is my own head that has struck the mud. I want to run down to lift her body, Joan, the maid, crumpled like a bag of old clothes. But I cannot move. My knees have given way beneath me. I am clinging to the stone battlements, and they are as cold as my scraped hands. I am not crying for her, though my breath is still coming in gulping sobs. I am frozen with horror. I am felled by horror. Joan was a young woman who tried to walk her own path in the world of men, just as my great aunt told me. And it led her to this cold tower, this swan dive, this death. They pick her up lifeless, and for 4 days she does not move or stir. But then she comes out of her stupor and gets up slowly from her bed, patting herself all over, as if to make sure that she is whole. Amazingly, no bones have been broken in her fall. She has not cracked her skull, nor snapped so much as a finger. It is as if her angels held her up, even when she gave herself into their element. Of course, this will not serve her. They are quick to say that only the devil could have saved a girl who went headfirst like that from such a tall tower. If she had died, they would have said God's justice had been done. My uncle, a man of dour common sense, says that the ground is so sodden after weeks of winter rain, and lapped by the moat, that she was in more danger of drowning than being broken. But now he is determined that she shall leave at once. He doesn't want the responsibility of the maid in his house, without the demoiselle to keep everything safe. He sends her first to his house in Arras, the Cour le Comte, and then we follow, as she is transferred to the English city of Rouen for trial. We have to attend. A great lord such as my uncle must be there to see justice being done, and his household must stand behind him. My aunt Jehanne takes me to witness the end of the Dauphin's holy guide, the pretend prophet of the pretend king. Half of France is trooping to Rouen to see the end of the maid, and we have to be foremost among them. For someone that they declare is nothing more than a peasant girl run mad, they are taking no chances. She is housed in the castle Beauvreuil and kept in chains, in a cell with a double-locked door and the window boarded over. They are all in a terror that she will run like a mouse under the door, or fly like a bird through a crack in the window. They ask her to give an undertaking that she will not try to escape, and when she refuses, they chain her to the bed. "She won't like that," my Aunt Jehanne says sorrowfully.
"No."
They are waiting for the Duke of Bedford, and in the very last days of December, he marches into the town with his guard dressed in the colour of roses, the bright red and white of England. He is a great man on horseback. He wears armour polished so brightly that you would take it for silver, and beneath his huge helmet his face is grave and stern, his big beak of a nose making him look like a predatory bird, an eagle. He was brother to the great English king, Henry V, and he guards the lands that his brother won in France at the great battle of Agincourt. Now the dead king's young son is the new victor of France, and this is his most loyal uncle. Seldom out of his armour or out of the saddle, never at peace. We are all lined up at the great gate of Beauvreuil as he rides in, and his dark gaze rakes us all, looking from one to another, as if to sniff out treason. My aunt and I curtsy low, and my Uncle John doffs his hat and bows. Our house has been in alliance with the English for years. My other uncle, Louis of Luxembourg, is the Duke's Chancellor, and swears that he is the greatest man ever to rule France. Heavily, he gets off his horse and stands like a fortress himself, as the men line up to greet him, bowing over his hand, some of them almost going down to their knees. A man comes forwards, and as Bedford acknowledges him with a lordly tip of his head, his glance goes over his vassal's head and sees me. I am staring at him, of course. He is the greatest spectacle on this cold winter day. But now he is looking back at me, and there is a flash in his eyes that I see and cannot recognize. It is something like a sudden hunger, like a fasting man seeing a banquet. I step back. I am neither afraid nor coquettish, but I am only 14 years of age, and there is something about the power of this man and his energy that I don't want turned in my direction. I slide back a little, so I am behind my aunt, and I watch the rest of the greetings masked by her headdress and veil. A great litter comes up, thick curtains tied tight with gold cord against the cold, and Bedford's wife, the Duchess Anne, is helped out. A small cheer greets her from our men. She is of the House of Burgundy, our liege lords and relations, and we all dip in a little bow to her. She is as plain as all the Burgundy family, poor things, but her smile is merry and kind, and she greets her husband warmly, and then stands with her hand comfortably tucked in the crook of his arm, and looks about her with a cheerful face. She waves at my aunt and points inside the castle to say that we must come to her later. "We'll go at dinner time," my aunt says to me in a whisper. "Nobody in the world eats better than the Dukes of Burgundy." Bedford takes off his helmet and bows to the crowd in general, raises a gauntleted hand to the people who are leaning from upper windows and balancing on garden walls to see the great man. Then he turns and leads his wife inside, and everyone has a sense that we have seen the cast of players and the opening scene of a travelling show. But whether it is a mask or a party, funeral rites or the baiting of a wild animal that has brought so many of the greatest people in France to Rouen, it is about to begin. Rouen, France. Spring 1431. And then they bodge it. They harass her with erudite questions, query her replies, double back on her answers, write down things she says in moments of weariness and bring them back to her later, define their terms in the most learned ways and ask her what she means, so that she doesn't understand the question and tells them simply, "Pass on," or "Spare me that." Once or twice she just says, "I don't know. I'm a simple girl with no learning. How would I know?" My uncle gets an anguished letter from Queen Yolande of Aragon, who says she's certain that the Dauphin will ransom Joan. She just needs another 3 days, another week to persuade him. Can we not delay the trial? Can we not ask for a few days' delay? But the church has the girl wound tight in the web of inquiry, and now they will never let her go. Everything that highly educated men can do to obscure a simple truth, to make a woman doubt her feelings, to make her own thoughts a muddle, they do to her. They use their learning as a hurdle to herd her one way and then another, and then finally trap her in contradictions of which she can make no sense. Sometimes they accuse her in Latin, and she looks at them, baffled by a language that she has only ever heard spoken in church, in the mass that she loves. How could these very sounds, these familiar, beloved tones, so solemn and musical to her, now be the voice of accusation. Sometimes they bring scandal against her in the words of her own people, old earthy stories from Domremy of vanity, of false pride. They say she jilted a man before marriage. They say she ran away from good parents. They say she worked in an alehouse and was free with her favours like any village slut. They say she rode with the soldiers as their doxy. They say she is no maid, but a harlot, and that everyone knew it. It takes Anne, the kind-hearted little Duchess of Bedford herself, to assert that Joan is a virgin, and to demand that the men who guard her are forbidden from touching or abusing her. They must be ordered that it is not the work of God to assault her. Then, as soon as this order is given, they say that since she is now so safe, guarded by the word of the Duchess, that she has no excuse for wearing men's clothes, and that she must dress in a gown, for now, they tell her, it is a sin, a mortal sin, to wear breeches. They turn her head, they puzzle her beyond bearing. They are great men of the church, and Joan is a peasant girl, a devout girl, who has always done as the priest ordered, until she heard the voices of angels who told her to do more. She cries in the end. She breaks down, and cries like a child. She puts on the gown, as they order her, and confesses to all the sins that they name to her. I don't know if she even understands the long list. She makes her mark on her confession. She writes her name and then signs a cross beside it, as if to deny her signature. She admits that there were no angels and no voices, and that the Dauphin is nothing more than the Dauphin, and not the King of France, that his coronation was a sham, and her beautiful armour an offence to God and man, and that she is a girl, a silly girl, who tried to lead grown men as if she could know the way better than they. She says she's a vain fool to think that a girl might lead men. She is a woman worse than Eve for giving advice, an assistant to the devil himself. What? Bellows the Duke of Bedford. We are visiting his wife, the Duchess, seated in her rooms before a good fire, a lute player twanging away in the corner, small glasses of the best wine on every table, everything elegant and beautiful. But we can hear his deplorable English bellow through two closed doors. We hear the doors bang as the Earl of Warwick flings himself out of the Duke's apartment to find out what has gone wrong, and in this revealing burst of rage we see, as if we had ever been in any doubt, that these English never wanted the church to wrestle with the soul of a mistaken girl and restore her to her senses, bring her to confession, penitence, and forgiveness. It has all along been nothing but a witch hunt, determined to find a witch, a bonfire looking for a brand, death waiting for a maiden. The Duchess goes to the door, and the servants throw it open before her so we can all hear, disastrously clearly, her husband bellow at Pierre Cauchon the bishop, Cauchon the judge, Cauchon the man, who is there apparently representing all at the same time God and justice and the church. For the sake of Christ! I don't want her pleading guilty. I don't want her recanting. I don't want her confessed and shriven. I don't bloody well want her imprisoned for life. What safety is there in that for me? I want her as a pile of ashes blowing away in the wind. How much clearer do I have to be? God damn, do I have to burn her myself? You said the church would do it for me. Do it. The Duchess steps back rapidly and gestures for the doors to her room to be closed, but we can still hear the regent swearing and damning his soul at the top of his voice. The Duchess shrugs. Men will be men, and this is wartime. And my aunt smiles understandingly. The lute player increases his volume as best he can and starts to sing. I go to the window and look out. In the market square, they have a half-built pyre, a strong structure with a big central beam and the wood strapped around it. Joan has confessed and recanted. She has been found guilty of her crimes and sentenced to imprisonment. But they are not taking the wood away. My aunt gives me a nod that we're going to leave, and I go to the hall to wait for her, as she delays inside the Duchess's rooms, saying a few words of farewell. I have my hood pulled up over my head, my hands tucked inside my cape. It is cold for May. I wonder if Joan has blankets in her cell, as the big double doors to the Duke's public rooms are thrown open, and the Duke himself comes quickly out. I sink down into a curtsy, and I imagine he can barely see me, wrapped in my dark cape in the shadowy doorway. I expect him to brush past, but he pauses.
Jacquetta? Jacquetta, St. Paul?
I sink even lower.
Yes, Your Grace.
He puts a firm hand under my elbow and raises me up. His other hand pushes back my hood and turns my face to the light of the open doorway, his hand under my chin as if I'm a child, and he's looking to see if my mouth is clean. His men are waiting for him. There must be a dozen people around us, but he acts as if we are quite alone. He stares at me intently, as if he would read me. I look back at him blankly. I don't know what he wants with me, and my aunt will be angry if I say the wrong thing to this most important man. I give my lip a little nip, and I hear his sudden intake of breath.
My God, how old are you?
I am 15 this year, Your Grace.
And here with your father?
With my uncle, Your Grace. My father is Pierre, the new Count of Luxembourg.
The new Count? He asks, staring at my mouth.
On the death of the Demoiselle of Luxembourg, I mutter. My father is now Count of Luxembourg. He was her heir.
Of course, of course.
There seems nothing else to say. But still he is staring at me. Still he holds me. One hand on my elbow, the other on the edge of my hood. Your Grace, I whisper, hoping he will come to his senses and let me go.
Jacquetta.
He whispers my name as if he's speaking to himself. May I serve you in some way?
I mean to say please let me go, but a girl of my age cannot say such a thing to the greatest man in France.
He gives a little choke.
Indeed, I think you may. Jacquetta, you are going to be a beautiful woman. A beautiful young woman.
I glance around. His entourage are waiting for him, hardly moving, pretending not to see, not to listen. Nobody here is going to tell him to let me go, and I cannot do so.
Do you have a sweetheart? Eh? Someone taking your fancy? Some cheeky little page boy giving you a kiss?
No, my lord. No, of course not.
I'm stammering as if I'm in the wrong, as if I have done something as stupid and as vulgar as he suggests. He is chuckling, as though to indulge me, but the grip on my elbow is hard, as if he is angry. I lean back from his grip, from his avid gaze.
My father is very strict, I say feebly. The honour of my family. I have been staying with my Uncle John and his wife Shahan. They would never allow...
You don't wish for a husband? He asks me, disbelievingly. Don't you think of the man who will marry you, when you are in your bed at night? Do you dream of a young husband, who will come for you like a troubadour, and speak of love?
I'm trembling now. This is a nightmare.
His grip is as hard as ever, but his hawkish face comes closer and closer, and now he is whispering in my ear. I begin to think he's gone mad. He looks at me as if he would eat me, and I have a shuddering sense of a world opening up before me that I don't want to know.
No, no,
I whisper. But then, as he doesn't release me but presses me closer, I have a sudden spurt of anger. I remember in a rush who I am, what I am. "May it please your grace, I am a maid," I say, the words tumbling. "A maid of the House of Luxembourg. No man has laid a hand on me. No man would dare. I was in the keeping of the Demoiselle of Luxembourg, a virgin like myself. I am fit to capture a unicorn, and should not be so questioned."
There is a noise from the Duchess's room, and the door behind us suddenly opens, and at once he drops me, like a boy throwing down a stolen pastry. He turns and stretches out both his hands to his plain little wife.
"My dear, I was just coming to find you."
Her bright gaze takes me in. My white face, my hood pulled back, and his rosy bonhomie.
"Well, here I am," she says dryly. "So you need look no more, and I see you found little Jacquettus and Paul instead."
I curtsy again, as he glances at me as if seeing me for the first time.
"Good day,"
he says carelessly. And to his wife he says confidentially,
"I must go. They're making a muddle of it. I have to go."
She nods her head to him with an easy smile, and he turns and goes out, all his men marching after him with a heavy tread. I dread his wife Anne asking me if her husband spoke to me, what he said, what I was doing with him in the darkness of the hall, why he spoke to me of love and troubadours. For I could not answer such questions. I don't know what he was doing. I don't know why he took hold of me. I feel sick, and my knees are trembling to think of his bright eyes on my face, and his insinuating whisper. But I know he had no right, and I know that I defended myself, and I know that it is true. I am a virgin so pure that I could capture a unicorn. But it is worse than this, far worse. She just looks at me steadily, and my sense of outrage slowly drains from me. For she does not ask me what I was doing with her husband. She looks at me as if she knows already. She looks me up and down, as if she knows everything. She gives me a small, complicit smile, as if she thinks I'm some little thief, and she has just caught me with my fingers in her purse.
Lord John, the Duke of Bedford, has his way. The great Earl of Warwick has his way. The great men of England have their way. Joan alone, without advisers to keep her safe, changes her mind about her confession, takes off her woman's gown, and puts her boy's clothes back on. She cries out that she was wrong to deny her voices, wrong to plead guilty. She is not a heretic. She is not an idolater. She is not a witch, or an hermaphrodite, or a monster. She will not confess to such things. She cannot force herself to confess to sins she has never committed. She is a girl, guided by the angels to seek the Prince of France and call him to greatness. She has heard angels. They told her to see him crowned as king. "This is the truth before God," she proclaims. And so the jaws of England snap shut on her with relish. From my room in the castle, I can see the pyre as they build it even higher. They build a stand for the nobility to watch the spectacle, as if it were a joust, and barriers to hold back the thousands who will come to see. Finally, my aunt tells me to put on my best gown and my tall hat and come with her. "I am ill. I cannot come," I whisper. But for once she is stern. I cannot be excused. I must be there. I must be seen, beside my aunt, beside Anne, the Duchess of Bedford. We have to play our part in this scene as witnesses, as women who walk inside the rule of men. I will be there to show how girls should be. Virgins who do not hear voices. Women who do not think that they know better than men. My aunt and the Duchess and I represent women as men would like them to be. Joan is a woman that men cannot tolerate. We stand in the warm May sunshine, as if we were waiting for the starting trumpet of a joust. The crowd is noisy and cheerful all around us. A very few people are silent. Some women hold a crucifix. One or two have their hands on a cross at their necks. But most people are enjoying the day out, cracking nuts and swigging from flasks. A merry outing on a sunny day in May, and the cheering spectacle of a public burning at the end of it. Then the door opens, and the men of the guard march out and push back the crowd, who whisper and hiss and boo at the opening inner door, craning their necks to be the first to see her. She does not look like my friend Joan. That's my first thought when they bring her out of the little sally port of the castle. She's wearing her boy's boots once more. But she's not striding out in her loose-limbed, confident walk. I guess that they have tortured her, and perhaps the bones of her feet are broken, her toes crushed on the rack. They half drag her, and she makes little paddling steps, as if she's trying to find her footing on uncertain ground. She is not wearing her boy's bonnet on her brown, cropped hair, for they have shaved her head, and she is as bald as a shamed whore. On her bare, cold scalp, stained here and there with dried blood where the razor has nicked her pale skin, they have crammed a tall hat of paper, like a bishop's mitre, and on it are written her sins, in clumsy block letters for everyone to see. Heretic. Witch. Traitor. She wears a shapeless white robe, knotted with a cheap piece of cord at her waist. It is too long for her, and the hem drags around her stumbling feet. She looks ridiculous, a figure of fun, and people start to catcall and laugh, and someone throws a handful of mud. She looks around, as if she is desperate for something. Her eyes dart everywhere, and I'm terrified that she will see me and know that I have failed to save her, that even now I am doing nothing, and I will do nothing to save her. I'm terrified that she will call my name, and everyone will know that this broken clown was my friend, and that I will be shamed by her. But she's not looking at the faces crowding around her, alight with excitement. She is asking for something. I can see her urgently pleading. And then a soldier, a common English soldier, thrusts a wooden cross into her hands, and she clutches it as they lift her and push her upwards to the bonfire. They have built it so high it is hard to get her up. Her feet scrabble on the ladder, and her hands cannot grip. But they push her roughly, cheerfully from behind, hands on her back, her buttocks, her thighs, and then a big soldier goes up the ladder with her and takes a handful of the coarse material of her robe and hauls her up beside him like a sack, turns her round and puts her back to the stake that runs through the pyre. They throw a length of chain up to him, and he loops it around and around her, and then fastens it with a bolt behind. He tugs at it, workmanlike, and tucks the wooden cross in the front of her gown, and in the crowd below, a friar pushes to the front and holds up a crucifix. She stares at it unblinkingly, and I know, to my shame, that I am glad she has fixed her eyes on the cross so that she will not look at me, in my best gown and my new velvet cap, among the nobility who are talking and laughing all around me. The priest walks around the bottom of the pyre reading in Latin, the ritual cursing of the heretic. But I can hardly hear him above the yells of encouragement, the rumble of growing excitement from the crowd. The men with the burning torches come from the castle and walk around the pyre, lighting it all the way around the base, and then laying the torches against the wood. Someone has dampened the wood so that it will burn slowly, to give her the greatest pain, and the smoke billows around her. I can see her lips moving. She's still looking at the upheld cross, and I see that she's saying, "Jesus, Jesus," over and over. And for a moment I think that perhaps there will be a miracle, a storm to drown the fire, a lightning raid from the Armagnac forces. But there is nothing, just the swirling thick smoke, and her white face, and her lips moving. The fire is slow to catch. The crowd jeers the soldiers for laying a poor bonfire. My toes are cramped in my best shoes. The great bell starts to ring, slowly and solemnly, and though I can hardly see Joan through the thickening cloud of smoke, I recognize the turn of her head under the great paper mitre as she listens, and I wonder if she is hearing her angels through the tolling of the bell, and what they are saying to her now. The wood shifts a little, and the flames start to lick. The inside of the pile is drier. They built it weeks ago for her. And now, with a crackle and a blaze, it is starting to brighten. The light makes the ramshackle buildings of the square jump and loom. The smoke swirls more quickly. The brightness of the fire throws a flickering glow on Joan, and I see her look up. Clearly I see her form the word Jesus. And then, like a child going to sleep, her head droops, and she is quiet. Childishly, I think for a moment perhaps she has gone to sleep. Perhaps this is the miracle sent by God. Then there is a sudden blaze, as the long white robe catches fire, and a tongue of flame flickers up her back, and the paper mitre starts to brown and curl. She is still, silent as a little stone angel. And the pyre shifts, and the bright sparks fly up. I grit my teeth, and I find my aunt's hand clutching mine. "Don't faint," she hisses. "You have to stand up." We stand, hand clasped, our faces quite blank, as if this were not a nightmare that tells me as clearly as if it were written in letters of fire what ending a girl may expect if she defies the rules of men and thinks she can make her own destiny. I am here not only to witness what happens to a heretic. I am here to witness what happens to a woman who thinks she knows more than men. I look through the haze of the fire to our window in the castle, and I see the maid, Elizabeth, looking down. She sees me look up at her, and our eyes meet, blank with horror. Slowly she stretches out her hand and makes the sign that Joan showed us that day by the moat in the hot sunshine. Elizabeth draws a circle in the air with her forefinger. The sign for the Wheel of Fortune, which can throw a woman so high in the world that she can command a king or pull her down to this, a dishonored, agonizing death. Castle of St. Paul, Artois, Spring 1433. After a few more months with my Uncle John, and then a year-long visit to our Brienne kinsfolk, my mother regards me as sufficiently polished to return home while they plan my marriage. And so I am living at our castle in St. Paul when we hear the news that Anne, Duchess of Bedford, has died, and the Duke is lost without her. Then a letter comes from my Uncle Louis, the Duke's Chancellor. "Jacquetta, this concerns you." My mother summons me to her rooms, where I find her seated, my father standing behind her chair. They both look at me sternly, and I make a rapid review of my day's doings.
I have not completed the many tasks that I'm supposed to do, and I skipped attendance at church this morning. My room is untidy, and I'm behind with my sewing, but surely my father wouldn't come to my mother's apartment to reprimand me for this. Yes, Lady Mother? My mother hesitates, glances up at my father, and then presses on. Of course, your father and I have been considering a husband for you, and we have been looking at who might be suitable. We hoped that... But it doesn't matter, for you are lucky. We have had a most advantageous offer. In short, your Uncle Louis has suggested you as a wife for the Duke of Bedford. I'm so surprised that I say nothing.
A great honour, my father says shortly. A great position for you. You will be an English duchess. The first lady after the king's mother in England. The first lady bar none in France. You should go down on your knees and thank God for this opportunity.
What?
My mother nods, confirming this. They both stare at me, expecting a response.
But his wife has only just died, I say weakly. Yes, indeed. Your Uncle Louis has done very well for you to get your name put forwards this early. I would have thought he would have wanted to wait a little while. Didn't the Duke see you at Rouen? My mother asks.
And then again in Paris?
Yes, but he was married, I say foolishly. He saw me...
I remember that dark, predatory look when I was little more than a girl, and my stepping behind my aunt to hide from it. I remember the shadowy hall and the man who whispered in my ear, and then went out to order the burning of the maid.
And the Duchess was there. I knew her, too. We saw her far more than we saw him.
My father shrugs. At any rate, he liked the look of you. And your uncle has put your name in his ear, and you are to be his wife.
He's very old, I say quietly, directing this at my mother.
Not very. A little over 40, she says.
And I thought you told me he was ill, I say to my father.
All the better for you, my mother says. Clearly she means that an elderly husband may be less demanding than a young one, and if he dies, then I shall be a dowager duchess at 17, which would be the only thing better than being a duchess at 17.
I had not looked for such an honour, I say feebly to them both. May I be excused? I fear I'm not worthy.
We are of the greatest family in Christendom, my father says grandly. Kin to the Holy Roman Emperor. How would you not be worthy?
You cannot be excused, my mother says. Indeed, you would be a fool to be anything but delighted. Any girl in France and England would give her right hand for such a match. She pauses and clears her throat. He is the greatest man in France and England after the King of England. And if the King were to die...
Which God forbid, my father says hastily.
God forbid, indeed. But if the King were to die, then the Duke would be heir to the throne of England, and you would be Queen of England. What do you think of that? I had not thought of marriage to such a man as the Duke.
Think now, then, my father says briskly, for he's coming here in April to marry you.
My Uncle Louis, who is Bishop of Terouan as well as the Duke's Chancellor, is both host and priest at this wedding of his own making. He entertains us in his episcopal palace, and John, Duke of Bedford, rides in with his guard in the English livery of red and white, as I stand in the doorway of the palace, in a gown of palest yellow, with a veil of tissue of gold floating from my high headdress. His page runs forward to hold his horse's head, and another kneels on the ground alongside and then drops to his hands and knees to form a human mounting block. The Duke climbs down heavily,
from the stirrup onto the man's back, and then steps down to the ground. Nobody remarks on this. The Duke is such a great man that his pages take it as an honour for him to stand on them. His squire takes his helmet and his metalled gauntlets and steps aside.
My lord.
My uncle the bishop greets his master with obvious affection, and then bows to kiss his hand. The Duke claps him on the back, and then turns to my father and my mother. Only when the courtesies with them are complete does he turn to me, and he steps forwards, takes both of my hands, pulls me towards him, and kisses me on the mouth. His chin is rough with stubble, his breath tainted. It's like being licked by a hound. His face seems very big as it comes down towards me, and very big as he moves away. He doesn't pause to look at me or to smile. Just that one aggressive kiss. Then he turns to my uncle and says, "Do you have no wine?" And they laugh, for it is a private joke, based on their years of friendship. And my uncle leads the way inside, and my mother and father follow them, and I'm left for a moment, looking after the older people, with the squire at my side. "My lady," he says. He has passed the Duke's armour to another, and now he bows to me and doffs his hat. His dark hair is cut straight in a fringe above his brows. His eyes are grey as slate, perhaps blue. He has a funny twist in his smile, as if something is amusing him. He is stunningly handsome. I can hear the ladies in waiting behind me give a little murmur. He makes a bow and offers me his arm to take me inside. I put my hand on his and feel the warmth of his hand through the soft leather of his glove. At once, he pulls off the glove so his fingers are holding mine. I feel as if I would like him to take my hand in his, to put his warm palm against mine. I feel I would like him to take hold of my shoulders, to grip me at the waist. I shake my head to clear my mind of such ridiculous thoughts, and I say abruptly, like an awkward girl, "I'll go in alone, thank you." And I drop his hand and follow them inside. The three men are seated, wine glasses in their hands. My mother is in a window embrasure, watching the servants bring little cakes and top up their glasses. I go to her side with her ladies-in-waiting, and my two little sisters, who are dressed in their best and trusted to stand with the adults on this most important day. I wish that I was 8 years old, like Isabel, and could look at John, Duke of Bedford, and marvel at his greatness, and know that he would say nothing to me, that he wouldn't even see me. But I'm not a little girl any more. And as I look across at him, he does see me. He looks at me with a sort of avid curiosity. And this time, there is nowhere for me to hide. My mother comes to my room the night before my wedding. She brings the gown for the next day and lays it carefully in the chest at the foot of my bed. The tall headdress and veil are mounted on a stand, safely out of the way of candles or dust. My maid is brushing my fair hair before the beaten silver mirror, but as my mother comes in, I say, "You can stop now, Margaret," and she twists the long fall into a loose plait, ties it with a ribbon, and goes from the room. Mother sits awkwardly on the bed. "I need to speak to you about marriage," she starts. "About what your duties will be as a married woman. I suppose you should know." I turn on my stool and wait, saying nothing. "This is a marriage of great advantage to you," she says. "We are of Luxembourg, of course, but to gain the position of an English duchess is a great thing." I nod. I wonder if she's going to say anything about what happens on the wedding night. I am afraid of the great Duke, and I'm dreading the thought of spending the night with him. The last wedding I went to, they put the couple in bed together, and in the morning they fetched them out with music and singing and laughing. Then the mother went in and brought out the sheets, and they were red with blood,
Nobody would tell me what had happened, if there had been some sort of accident. Everyone behaved as if everything was quite wonderful, as if they were pleased at the sight of blood on the linen. Indeed, they were laughing and congratulating the bridegroom. I wonder if my mother's going to explain now.
But for him, it is not a marriage of advantage, she says. It may cost him very dear.
The jointure? I ask, thinking that it must cost him money to pay my allowance.
His allies, she says.
He has been in alliance with the Dukes of Burgundy to fight against the Armagnacs. England couldn't have fought such a war without their support. His wife was Anne of Burgundy, the present Duke was her brother, and she made it her business to keep her brother and her husband in good friendship. Now she has died. There is no one to keep the friendship, no one to help them resolve their disagreements. Well, I can't, I say, thinking of the Duke of Burgundy, whom I've seen half a dozen times in my whole life, while certainly he has never noticed me at all.
You'll have to try, my mother says. It will be your duty, as an English duchess, to hold Burgundy in alliance with England. Your husband will expect you to entertain his allies and to be charming.
Charming?
Yes. But there is a difficulty. Because my Lord John of Bedford is marrying you so soon after the death of his wife, the Duke of Burgundy is offended at the insult to his dead sister. He has taken it badly.
Then why are we marrying so quickly? I ask. If it upsets the Duke of Burgundy, surely we should leave it a year and not displease him. He is our kinsman as well as the Duke of Bedford's ally. Surely we should not offend him.
My mother smiles faintly. It makes you a duchess, she reminds me. A greater title even than mine.
I could be a duchess next year.
The thought of escaping this marriage, even for a year, fills me with hope.
We could just be betrothed.
Lord John won't wait, she says flatly. So don't hope for that. I just want to warn you that he may lose his ally by marrying you. You must do all that you can to retain the friendship of the Duke of Burgundy, and remind them both that you are a kinswoman of Burgundy and his vassal. Speak to the Duke of Burgundy privately, and promise him that you remember your kinship to the Burgundians. Do all you can to keep the friendship between the two of them, Draqueta. I nod. I really don't know what she thinks I can do, a 17-year-old girl, to maintain an alliance of two great men old enough to be my father, but I will have to promise to do my best.
And the marriage, I begin.
Yes? I take a breath.
What exactly happens?
She shrugs. She makes a little face, as if to talk of it is beneath her, or embarrassing, or even worse, too disagreeable for words. Oh, my dear, you just do your duty. He will tell you what he expects. He will tell you what to do. He won't expect you to know anything. He will prefer to be your instructor.
Does it hurt? I ask.
Yes, she says unhelpfully, but not for very long. Since he's older and practiced, he should do his best to see that you're not hurt too badly. She hesitates. But if he does hurt you...
Yes?
Don't complain of it.
The wedding is to be at midday, and I start preparing at 8 in the morning... when my maid brings me bread and meat and small ale to sustain me through the long day. I giggle when I see the tray heaped with food. I'm not going out hunting, you know.
No, she says ominously. You are to be hunted. And the other maids with her all cackle like a pen of hens, and that is the last joke I'm going to offer all day. I sit at the table in a sulk, and eat.
while they embroider versions of the theme of my being hunted and caught and enjoying the chase, until my mother comes in, and behind her come two serving men, rolling the great wooden barrel of a bath. They place it before the fire in my bedroom, line it with linen, and start to pour in jug after jug of hot water. The maids bustle about bringing drying sheets and start to lay out my new undergowns, with much comment about the lace and the ribbons and how fine everything is, and how lucky I am. My mother sees my strained expression and shoos them all from the room except our old nursemaid, who is to scrub my back and wash my hair and add jugs of hot water. I feel like a sacrificial lamb being cleaned and brushed before having its throat cut, and it's not a pleasant thought. But our nursemaid Mary is cheerful and full of her usual clucking approbation of my beautiful hair and my beautiful skin, and if she had half my looks she would have run away to Paris, as ever. And when I have bathed and she has dried my hair and plaited it, I cannot help but be encouraged by the linen undergown with the new ribbons, and by the new shoes, and by the beautiful cloth of gold gown, and the headdress. The maids come back in to help me dress, and tie the laces of the gown, and straighten my headdress, and pull the veil over my shoulders, and finally pronounce me ready for my wedding, and as beautiful as a bride should be. I turn to the great looking-glass that my mother has ordered to be carried into my chamber, and my reflection looks back at me. The maids hold it before me and tip it slightly downward so that I can first see the hem of my gown, embroidered with little red lions rampant, from the standard of our house, and my red leather slippers with the curling toes. Then they hold the mirror straight, and I can see the cloth of gold gown gathered at the high waist, and the embroidered heavy belt of gold that is slung low over my slim hips. I gesture, and they raise the mirror, so I can see the expensive cream lace veiling the low-cut neck of the gown, the gold sleeves falling from my shoulders, with the white linen undergown revealed tantalizingly through the slashings at the shoulders. And then my face. My fair hair is plaited away and tucked under the tall headdress, and my face looks solemnly at me, enhanced by the silvery reflection of the mirror. My grey eyes are wide in this light, my skin clear and pearly. The mirror makes me look like a statue of a beauty, a marble girl. I gaze at myself as if I would know who I am, and for a moment I think I see Melusina, the founder of our house, looking back at me through moonlit water. "When you are a duchess, you will have a great mirror of your own," my mother says. "Everything fine. And you will have all her old clothes."
"Duchess Anne's clothes?"
"Yes," she says, as if wearing the wardrobe of a recently dead woman should be a great treat for me. "Her sables are the best I've ever seen. Now they will be yours."
"Wonderful," I say politely. "Will I get my own clothes as well?"
She laughs. "You will be the first lady in France, all but the first lady in England. You will be able to have whatever your husband wants to give you. And you will soon learn how to persuade him." A woman whispers something behind her hand about how a girl like me might persuade a man as old as he with one hand tied behind her back. Someone says, "Better with both hands tied," and a couple of them laugh. I have no idea what they mean. "He will love you," my mother promises. "He is quite mad for you." I don't reply. I just look at the young woman in the mirror. The thought of John, Duke of Bedford, running mad for me is not encouraging at all. The wedding service lasts about an hour. It is all in Latin, so half of the vows are incomprehensible to me anyway. It is not a private plighting of promises,
but more a great announcement, as the hall of the bishop's palace fills with strangers come to look at me and celebrate my good fortune. When the vows are done,